You're listening to UK Health Radio. I'm Dr. Dean Mitchell, and this is The Smartest Doctor in the Room, where real medicine meets real answers. Each episode, I bring you honest conversations with some of the brightest minds in health and medicine. Let's get started. Toxic mold exposure in the home is dangerous to your health. I see patients every week in my practice who are suffering from the effects of toxic mold. And in many cases, they were living in a home where they didn't even know mold was present. That's why I recommend to patients who suspect they are ill, possibly from toxic mold exposure, to obtain a test from Immunolytics, a company that specializes in mold detection with simple mold plates for your home or office. The mold plates are put in various rooms of your home and then left open for an hour. They are then closed up and you observe them for 5 days. If the mold plates show growth, you can send them back to Immunolytics and the company will analyze them and interpret the results for you. Please see the link in the show notes to order your mold plates from Immunolytics and use the code SMARTESTDOC to get a 5% discount. Today's podcast is how a steak dinner killed an airline pilot. I know this headline is a shocker, and you're probably thinking the pilot must have died from choking or food poisoning, but he didn't. The mysterious cause of this pilot's death was actually due to an allergic reaction, a deadly allergic reaction, and that's what we're going to be discussing today. My guest today is Dr. Thomas Platts-Mills. He's an internationally respected allergist, immunologist, researcher. He's a professor at the University of Virginia. So I'm really pleased to welcome Dr. Thomas Platts-Mills to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why did you choose allergy? And I'm just curious. I believe you're from the UK originally. Is that right?
And yes, absolutely. I went to high school, college, and medical school in England, and was doing residency in the country, and I passed my boards exam. And then one of the consultants in the hospital where I worked got a message from a professor at Hopkins saying they would really like some English residents to come and do fellowship at Hopkins. Because for some reason, during the previous 10 years, when the Vietnam War was crazy, very few British people were willing to come to the States. And I came, I then applied, and they said there were three laboratories I could work in, possibly I could apply to. But one of them was Dr. Kimishige Ishizaka.
Oh, yes, very famous.
Basically discovered IgE.
Right.
Together with the Swedish group.
Right.
And so I applied, and they looked at my CV, and they looked at what I hadn't done. I had done, but what I hadn't done was much more at that time. And they had just received a training grant, much too late to get American fellows. So they said, all right, let him come. And I came. And
Were you interested in allergy at that time? It was just an interesting opportunity.
I didn't know what the word meant. Honestly, the amount we learned in medical school about allergy could be...
Right, it's probably a paragraph.
back of a postage stamp, yes. No, there was very little. Although there was some good allergy going on, including the first controlled trial of grass pollen immunotherapy by Bill Franklin and Rosa Augustine. So there was stuff going on, but I didn't know about it. And so I went to Hopkins, and it turned out that they really didn't need a clinical fellow. And so they called me a clinical fellow, but I went to clinic two or three times per year, slightly less than today, and worked in the lab, and really learned how to behave in a lab, how to do experiments, and then above all, how to write them up from Dr. Ishizaka.
And I spent
3 years in Baltimore.
That's interesting. You know, it's so funny. One of my other guests, I had Dr. David Golden, he was Canadian, and he had like a little bit of a similar story. They sent him to Hopkins to train, and he became a big, a venom researcher. Because in Canada, they didn't apparently have anybody. And it's interesting that Hopkins recruits people from around the world, because obviously, yeah, you do get all these different people with different skill sets. Okay, let's get into this condition, which you'll correct me, but I believe you are the one who discovered this, is what's called the alpha-gal syndrome, which again, for the common lay people, is called red meat allergy syndrome. Well, let me tell the story quickly, then I'm going to hear all your story, how you discovered this. In the story in the New York Times a few weeks ago, it was quite fascinating, actually. The headline was, again, this pilot's mysterious death. And what was really mysterious about it was he was basically a fairly healthy person. He was having these reactions, which were a little bit confusing because he would have go out to have dinner at night or a barbecue, and a few hours later he was getting abdominal distress, just feeling quite ill. It almost looked like food poisoning. And then, unfortunately, he must have gone to a barbecue or something, and a few hours later, again, swelling, not feeling well, only unfortunately this time he was discovered by his son, to be dead. And and unfortunately he passed away, and nothing was really looked into at the time. But then apparently there was a Dr. McFeely, who's a friend of the family. She wasn't a doctor on his case or anything, and she kept on was curious about this the mysteriousness of this death. And and she, I guess, looked into it further and found out maybe, I guess he was an outdoors type of person also, and had a whole bunch of these tick bites. And then I believe got in touch with you, Dr. Plasma. I'm gonna let you tell the story now. And it turned out that I guess from autopsy they found the antibodies in his blood, and he was diagnosed with this alpha-gal red meat allergy syndrome. Am I saying that correctly?
No, let me just correct one
Yeah,
bit.
please go ahead. Sorry.
The person who did the autopsy was given no clues at all, didn't really know about the previous abdominal pain properly, did know about the story on the day, but had no allergy sense to it. And they, when ultimately they sent us the serum, which we did the assays on, and we had them done, they said at that time, "We want to sure tell you again that we found nothing at post-mortem that suggested he died of anaphylaxis," which is really rather an important lesson. That is, an undesigned post-mortem doesn't routinely identify anaphylaxis. So his wife was told there was no apparent cause of death. So she was in a terrible situation personally. Not only had she lost her husband, but if one of the neighbors said, "Why did he die?" she would have to say, "I don't know," which was, ridiculous for a healthy 47-year-old man. And he was, I mean, as I say, relatively right young.
Yeah, 47 is pretty young. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and the other thing, the situation with Erin McFeely is really nice because they were friends for a really good suburban reason. That is that their daughters, the daughters of both families, were in the same ballet class. So the mothers would meet at the ballet class, nothing to do with this. But after he died, widow contacted Erin McFeely and they discussed it. And then I think it's his widow who said, "Could this be the red meat story?" And they were slow to get it. And after the abdominal pain episode, they didn't get it. They didn't realize what had happened. And it's if you read the New York Times, I spoke with his wife. She was very helpful, but Joseph Goldberg, Goldstein, Joseph Goldstein, I think I got
The
his
name of the
name.
pilot?
No, who wrote the paper article in the New York Times.
Oh, okay, yes.
I'm going to put him as an author on my next paper. He spoke to his wife.
Hi, everyone. I know you may already know from listening to my podcast that I specialize in treating patients with toxic mold exposure. It's become a serious problem for many years as we deal with the hurricanes and floods throughout the country. Even simple bathroom water leaks from a toilet in your home over time can contribute to mold buildup. I can help patients that suffer from the symptoms of toxic mold, but I also rely on the patients getting their current residence inspected so they are not continually being exposed. My go-to person for mold exposure is Joe Reese. Joe is a certified mold inspector
with decades of experience. He is super thorough and gives you a straightforward assessment and tells you whether it's safe to live in your home or if there is mold. I should know. I used Joe when I moved to my new home 4 years ago. Fortunately, when I moved in, I smelled an unusual odor in my basement and I immediately called Joe. He came over with his instruments and he found the problem. Afterwards, I had remediation and the problem was solved. Joe does inspections all throughout the country. He welcomes calls to his cell phone at 908-451-4592. You can also reach him by email at jprconsultants7929@gmail.com. Remember, mold in your home is not a good thing, but thankfully it's a problem that can be fixed.
We got an extraordinary description of her sitting next to her husband in August last year, with her husband writhing in pain, unable to talk to her, and she was in tears. I mean, that's a very severe episode of abdominal pain. Mm. And one of the real questions about our paper is, if you have a very severe episode of abdominal pain, is that a reason for going to a doctor? And traditionally, it's not. If you've got a headache, which was the worst in your life, you go to the emergency room. If you have chest pain, you go to the emergency room for sure. But abdominal pain, it's not clear that that's an inevitable indication for being investigated. And I think in a young man, there's a good case.
Well, you know, when you bring up one other really important point, too, that and again, a lot of these cases, abdominal pain is the predominant symptom. We don't always really know, you know, associate with an allergy. And these patients are seeing most likely a general doctor or their gastroenterologist who yep. may not really be very aware of this condition. And that's why it gets missed.
One of the authors, Nathan Richards, is actually the first author on a paper about abdominal pain presenting to gastroenterologists, because his father's a gastroenterologist. And they published the first paper on the subject as a general question to the GI audience.
Yeah. You know, Dr. Pletz-Mills, when people have tick bites, and I have a guest coming on in 2 weeks, he was supposed to be on today, but we think about Lyme disease and all those other infectious causes, Bartonella, babesiosis. People don't tend to think about an allergy. So I'm really curious, and again, going back to the 2000s, when I think you were the first one to describe this, how did you make this connection that tick bites were causing this type of reaction?
Well, actually, the most important thing is that when we started to see the cases, we were finding cases in Charlottesville in the middle of Virginia and heard from other allergists in the state, but also from allergists in North Carolina, Tennessee, Oklahoma, and southern Missouri, that they'd also seen cases. Whereas, let me just pursue that, but I want to go back to something. These cases were in an area that looked like the distribution of Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
Oh.
But actually, it's a curious issue that the definition of Rocky Mountain spotted fever at that time was an IgG antibody to a rickettsial antigen.
Right.
And the Lone Star tick carries a rickettsia amblyommii, which is not the cause of Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
station that makes you feel good.
But Cross reacts with it badly, so that if you came into a hospital with a fever and this IgG antibody rickettsia in Virginia, you might be called officially Rocky Mountain spotted fever, although it wasn't very severe. Rocky Mountain spotted fever is a really dangerous disease.
Right, you could die from that if you're not treated quickly.
You can certainly die from it, but that wasn't what these cases were. But we got the idea of ticks, and then we started asking questions.
All right, so let me ask you this, too, because what's also fascinating about Lyme disease, which I've studied when I was in residency a little bit, and I'm going to be speaking to someone about it, you know, it was a combination of, I mean, it was very fortunate with Lyme. Alan Stier, who's very famous for helping discover Lyme disease, had, besides his rheumatology background, was also trained at the CDC here in the United States as an epidemiologist. In your case, so you're saying you were seeing these cases from around those areas, and then you kind of put it to like an epidemiologist and said, hey, what's going on here?
No, I put it to my technician. I said, Jake, just Google that map and tell me what it looks like. And 2 days later, he said, the only thing I can see is Rocky Mountain.
You know, that picture I'm putting up here, because this is an article actually from the Cleveland Clinic Journal, but I think it kind of depicts, it's like an ink blot of those areas. The reason I'm bringing it up is because in New York, where I am, you know, we always associated Lyme and now alpha-gal, actually, the most amount of cases are out in the Hamptons.
And there's another Erin in the Hamptons called Erin.
Do I know of her? Right, correct.
I've seen a lot of cases.
I've seen a lot of cases.
Early on, a year into talking about this, I came to the Long Island Allergy Society and actually introduced her to the other allergist in that area. And then he said, I saw Erin, I saw you when you were a child as a patient. She didn't know it. But no, it's very good. There is actually a flyway from Virginia, a bird flyway, to the end of the Long Island, to the Hamptons. And if you put a radioactive tick in the in Norfolk, it'll turn up.
Wow.
So the Lone Star tick probably ended up in the north there being carried on birds.
So then how did you still do? Okay, so you started to say, this could be somehow tick related, even though there had really never been before a tick known transmitted allergic reaction, right? Correct?
I don't believe there was.
Yes, I mean, so this was totally novel thinking.
There are other people who had noticed a connection between tick bites and red meat allergy, but they didn't know what was going on, and they couldn't get there because the way we got there is something different, which is...
Well, explain to me, how did you get there?
Well, it's the cetuximab question.
Okay. Please explain to the listeners. What is cetuximab?
Cetuximab is a monoclonal antibody against epidermal growth factor receptor created by ImClone. An ImClone expressed the molecule in SP2O, which is a mouse cell line. And that molecule, it turned out, was the target of these IgE antibodies, and cetuximab was causing bad reactions in the same area that we saw the cases.
Okay.
So we now knew that these two things were happening in the same place. But interestingly, ImClone gave us the same amino acid sequence expressed in a different cell line, that is a mouse cell line, and that bound IgE antibodies. If they gave us the same molecule in Chinese hamster ovary cell line, it did not. And so it turns out that the Chinese hamster ovary line, which is used very extensively by Genentech, does not put alpha-gal on these cells, on the amino acids it produces. So the question is, why doesn't CHO do that? And it turns out that CHO was grown in human serum for several years with multiple replications and multiple different forms of the molecule of the cell line. And during that time, your serum, Dean Mitchell, I can assure you, has IgG antibodies to alpha-gal, which you make in your gut. And And every single human who's been examined makes IgG antibodies to alpha-Gal. If you grow a cell line with this antibody around it, the cells that make less and less of it will be encouraged. And we think that's how it happened.
Okay, so wait, I want to clarify this for the listeners because, again, you're so knowledgeable and it gets very technical. But basically, what you were seeing, which was quite unique, and that's why clinical observation, although you always said you were a researcher, I think you're a very good clinician. You were seeing that there were these people apparently having reactions after eating red meat, which again was confusing because it could be several hours later. In allergy, we tend to associate allergic food reactions with immediate reactions. And on the other hand, you were seeing these patients being treated with cetuximab, which is used, so just for the listeners know, this is used, I believe, for colon cancer, and I think squamous cell cancer, a couple of specific cancers. It's a very important curing drug. And these patients were getting very violent allergic reactions, which just didn't seem to make sense because there was,
That's right.
no connection.
When the Robert O'Neill was an oncologist in Chapel Hill, and he cases from Chapel Hill and from Vanderbilt, and reported them to their national meeting up in New York. And the senior oncologist, cancer oncologist in New York, said to him after he talked, "I don't know whether you're lying or crazy." That is, he couldn't, it's unbelievable, it's been published. He couldn't believe that this drug was causing so much trouble in the South and nothing in New York.
Right, so that's again, that's another thing. Again, as clinicians observing, why when in a certain country people are having bad reactions, whereas in other parts of the country it's a lot less. Again, strange. I always say, people sometimes ask me why I went into allergy, and I say, I always want to be a medical detective. The things that are not obvious, and that you have to do the digging and the research and use your tools. But that's essentially what you were doing. And then I guess at that point you were making that association and you were able to come up with a laboratory test to check for the IgE because I assume it didn't exist before.
Of course not. And nobody knew that alpha-Gal could be a target for IgE antibodies. And actually, for the first 10 years, our lab used cetuximab itself on the ImmunoCAP to measure IgE antibodies to alpha-Gal. But the FDA would not approve that because they won't approve a test that uses a drug as the target when you're actually trying to measure something different. Because it's too confusing in relation to, so that if you get, I mean, obviously where we live, most patients getting cetuximab today are screened for IgE to alpha-Gal before.
Right. That's extremely important for our listeners. Again, too, if God forbid you have certain cancer that requires cetuximab, your doctors are most likely screening you so you don't get a bad reaction. I have one other quick question for you too. I believe, I don't know if he's still there, Dr. Robert Schwartz. He was a big anaphylaxis researcher. I think he was at UVA, and he was very big with tryptase. I'm just curious, tryptase for our listeners,
No, whoa, whoa,
that's
whoa,
what's
whoa, whoa! Slow
present in the
down,
blood in anaphylactic
Dean.
reactions. Were you seeing
Dean.
high tryptase levels or did it fade out in these patients?
Dean, you're using his wrong name. It's Larry Schwartz.
Larry Schwartz, excuse me.
Larry
Thank
Schwartz
you.
is in Richmond. He's at ECU. He's a very good friend, and
Okay.
he developed the test, and he published the original data with the tryptase test, and then he developed a better test, and that's the one we use today. And
And
that's.
were you seeing that elevated in any of the, or is it too late? I'm curious because, as you well know, tryptase is elevated like in the first 6 hours of an anaphylactic reaction and then it dies down. But I'm curious because these are sort of delayed reactions in general, these people getting so sick. Did their trip, like I say again, if a
No.
doctor, if somebody came into the emergency room and they were having some type of, it looked like an allergic reaction besides the abdominal pain, maybe trouble breathing or urticaria, and the doctor was smart enough to say, well, I don't know, maybe this is red meat alpha-Gal, I gotta treat like an allergy, but I can't get an alpha-Gal blood test like that, but maybe my lab can get a tryptase or at least I should draw it. Would that still be elevated?
Yes.
It would be.
Yes, absolutely. The next day, we've had patients come in here. One guy in particular, he ate meat. 3.5 hours later, he starts itching. He sits down on the floor, realizes he's in trouble, and rings 911. The two ambulance attendants weighed less. They each of them weighed less than half what he weighed, and they couldn't carry him. But he lived on a trail in a mobile home, and they had to get him to stand up. And he stood up, walked to the ambulance, but he was fully conscious, but went blind. And he lost sight altogether.
Why?
Blood pressure was recorded at one point at 40 over nothing.
Oh, that's why he went blind. He lost the circulation.
He can lose circulation of his cortex, but remain conscious. Most people will go unconscious before they realize that they're blind. So it's very unusual. His tryptase was 90.
Wow.
Which is the highest value I've ever seen in a person who survived. But remember, our patient that we published had a tryptase reported as 2,000.
Wow. And listeners can't appreciate this. These are super high levels.
These are in the high levels. And the only good place they've been published before was a paper by John Junginger from the Mayo in the early years of the test. And he said that patients who got venom anaphylaxis could have levels like 2,000 or 1,000. But if you ask most people in our practice, Mike Nelson, you know, is our division now. And I asked him, what's the highest level? He's in a value over 100. It's very unusual. But
would you say, though, do like 95% of these patients have GI symptoms? I mean, can present where they do not have gastrointestinal symptoms?
No.
If you've been following the podcast, you may know I practice holistic functional medicine and immunology. In fact, at Mitchell Medical Group, we've been treating chronic fatigue patients for 3 decades. It's critical in this work to have a trusted pharmacy that can compound medications for our sensitive patients' needs. ITC Pharmacy has been our go-to pharmacy the entire time. They can make medications ranging from thyroid hormones to dye-free medications for all of our highly sensitive, even allergic patients. If you or your holistic doctor are looking for these very specific patient medications, you can contact ITC at 888-349-5453. They have licenses throughout the country and can have medications delivered right to your doorsteps. My patients have been so pleased with their service, and you will be too.
Absolutely. Absolutely not. You can have hives only. I get hives only. I've been covered in hives. The first time I had a bad reaction,
You've had alpha gal yourself?
Well, I'm a real scientist.
Oh, you made sure to give it to yourself.
I did not give it to myself, but I went for a walk and got 200 seed ticks on me, the baby larvae, the larvae of the Lone Star tick.
Right.
And I actually sent them to a real acarologist at Cal Berkeley, and he said they are larval Lone Star ticks. And in this area, they're normally referred to as chiggers. But chiggers is a bad mistake because people don't associate chiggers with ticks. And actually, his widow, when I asked her, has he had tick bites this year? And she said, no, he's had them in the past. I said, has he had chiggers? Oh, yes, he had 13 chiggers around his ankles back 2 months earlier. And I think that's when he got the boost that made him sensitive.
You know, one other thing, too, talking about laboratory testing, and this, too, I almost got fooled a few months ago because a patient was referred to me about for alpha-gal. I mean, the doctor was smart enough to be concerned, you know, because of the patient's reactions. And my patient had an alpha-gal level of like 0.139.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And when you look at the scale of things, and I'm used to reading it, you know, I like to order a lot of blood testing for allergies. I find it more precise. It seemed like a very, very low level, you know, because like anything we do in allergy, we look at obviously a degree, like if it's peanut allergy, you know, it can correlate to the severity. But, you know, in this paper I'm looking at, anything greater than 0.1, you know, kilouniunits per liter is a positive test. So I mean, should it be zero? I mean, you should be zero if you do not have a problem. Or close to zero?
In my world, there's no such thing as zero. Just tell me how much you could measure. And there's no doubt there are patients being diagnosed with today or being told they have alpha-gal on levels that are very low. And sometimes they've got an alternative explanation, which is much, much higher.
Okay.
And so that would be very suspicious about a level of that kind.
Oh, you would. So this was in an article from the Cleveland Clinic Journal, which is good. You know, they have a good journal. I was surprised. They said, so just out of, in your experience, what is a concerning level to you where you'd say, pretty good. Again, with clinical history.
Well, actually, the value that we use a lot of the time is if it's low, if it's less than 2, I want to know what it is, but I want to know what the total IgE is.
That's a good point.
One of the very early cases we saw had an IgE of 10, and you're saying, not allergic. Her IgE to alpha-gal was 4.
Wow.
If it's
a big percentage, 10, right.
And it's highly likely to be responsible for what's happening. Mm. She is not an allergic person otherwise. And we see plenty of those.
Oh, interesting. Very interesting. Good
so
point.
Again, if it's the value we published was 0.7, but his total IgE was 16. So that's 3.4%. I think that's right. Something like that.
Right.
Anyway, but the point was that we, too complicated maybe, but we had a little bit of trouble getting the serum here, and we're not sure it didn't get heated slightly in the FedEx van on the way down here because there was a storm in Newark and bringing the serum down. But the relationship between the specific and total should be correct, and the trip days we're sure was correct. And I'm absolutely... I personally believe that the history we had, which was that he ate beefsteak in August, 4 hours later he had this terrible abdominal pain and nothing before that. And then in September he went to a barbecue, ate a hamburger, and 4 hours later goes to the bathroom. His son hears him making weird noises, goes in and finds him unconscious on the floor, and he never recovered. And that,
well, just interesting. Why do you think you didn't get GI symptoms? I mean, because it wasn't related with food, or you're just not sure? There's no reason.
Man in the moon.
Okay.
I don't know. You've got to explain the delay. Maybe one of the most important things of this case is that when he's going to have a reaction, which was fatal, he had no symptoms in that 4-hour period. He was at home. He went out in the garden, mowed the lawn for half an hour, came in. He was sitting comfortably when his wife went out to take their daughter to another barbecue. And then within 20 minutes of her leaving the house, her son was on the phone saying, I think it's getting sick again. And she said, you've got to go in. So she left at 7 o'clock. And by 7:37, her son is phoning 911.
Wow.
A woman does not forget when they're supposed to take her to a barbecue. That's solid stuff. And 7:37 is a legal record.
That's incredible.
And that was one of the best things about this case, is that when we got from the wife and the daughter and Erin McFeely, it was very, very convincing that we knew pretty well what happened.
Dr. Plessmos, let me ask you this too. This is very important for the listeners, because it's a little tricky too. So one of the, obviously the most prominent things about this alpha-gal syndrome is that the patients are, they develop this allergy to red meats, such as beef, pork, lamb, venison, rabbit, goat, buffalo,
squirrel,
squirrel. I mean, I don't need squirrels.
I come from Virginia. We all
maybe Virginia squirrels. But there are other things. I want to just bring this up because they mentioned, now cow's milk. Is that because of the cross reactivity with beef? Like, why would milk cause contribute to the alpha gal syndrome?
Dean, I know you live in New York, but actually, we in the country know that milk comes out of a package.
All right, but I know there's some cross reactivity. Okay,
No, it's just alpha gal, as far as we know. But really severe reactions to less.
Okay. Because I also thought I read somewhere like cheese also. For some reason, cheese.
Cheese is made of milk too.
I know. I wasn't sure if it had to do with the content. I know. I really haven't been near a farm in quite a while.
Excuse me for being rude about New Yorkers, but I've been married.
No, it's okay. You can bash it.
My wife is a New Yorker.
I'm going to talk to her after
years,
this.
50 punishing years.
That's where it is. I can tell you that's where that British humor is coming through piercingly. Okay.
Now, my father-in-law was the man in the world.
Okay. That's good to know. A couple of other things too, you know, again, patients should be aware of this. Like, for example, you know, things that contain gelatins, you know, such as in marshmallows, gummy bears, you know, again, even children, I assume, can get this.
Yeah. Children can get it. We don't have as many cases. But definitely they can get it. I've not seen cases anywhere near of the level of we've seen in adults, but maybe for, you know, one of the other problems with the whole area is that these sugars are digested quite rapidly in the gut, and glycoproteins are digested very rapidly. Glycolipids are different. So just an important message that blood group substance on the surface of a red cell is just as much on glycolipids as it is on glycoproteins. And alpha-gal is a blood group substance very similar to B. So can I just say this?
Yes.
B is galactose with a fucose on the side of the galactose. Alpha-gal is galactose 1,3 galactose and glycac, but without fucose. So that those two are both blood group substances, but alpha-gal is different. And we don't make it, but we can make, of course, B blood group.
And then, you know, you bring up so many points. I just want to touch on these, because it was in this article in the Cleveland Journal that also blood types A and O are at the highest risk of developing alpha-gal. Is that also in your experience, or?
It is not completely wrong, but it's not as complete. And actually, B is relatively rare in the United States, and so it's difficult to get the numbers straight. But there are several studies where it appears to be less. But in one of our studies, the B blood group substance patients have less prevalence, but more severity if they get it. So,
oh wow!
I'm not answering your question correctly. I'm not answering your question completely.
No, I see what you're saying. You don't think, because who's really checking your blood type anyway? I mean, it's a little bit irrelevant. What about, though, these important risk factors, though, too, like alcohol and NSAIDs, non-steroidals, exercise? I mean, they say they would increase the food absorption. Is that why?
We think that the effect of alcohol, most of the data we know about, is alcohol at the time of it, not at the time when you're going to get symptoms.
Mm.
And my first real attack, I drank 3 glasses of red wine and I eaten 3 lamb chops. And as my wife says, once you've drunk 2 glasses of red wine, you can't count. I don't know what I was being foolish. And when I stood up in the hotel in London, covered in hives, I thought to myself, you fool, you've done it. My levels of antibody levels had gone up, but I didn't realize that I was that close. But I didn't feel sick. I didn't feel anaphylactic at all. I had no abdominal pain. I was standing up. I'd feel
good. And how did you treat yourself? Just with some antihistamines? Or you let it pass?
Nothing.
Well, you're like one of the old school warriors. Just let it ride.
I was in a hotel room and I couldn't be bothered to go downstairs. So I went to bed and half an hour later, I fell asleep.
You bring up the one question patients ask that I have seen that have alpha gal, as you can, I'm sure you could read my mind on this. Their biggest question is, like with a lot of food allergies, but especially when it comes to meat, when am I going to be able to eat a steak again? So maybe you could answer that question in general, or how somebody should be monitored
The
who is
best
dying to have that juicy steak, although it could kill them.
answer is emu.
I'd like to take a moment to let my listeners know that my new book, Conquering Candida, is now available on Amazon in paperback and ebook. If you believe you suffer from Candida, this is the first book in 50 years since the original book, The Yeast Connection by Dr. William Crook, to give credence to this underdiagnosed and undertreated condition. If you also want to understand gut health and the microbiome, I also believe you will enjoy this book. I do appreciate if you read this book to rate it on Amazon and provide your comments and a review.
Emu is an ostrich, type of ostrich.
Oh, type of, oh, because they don't have the alpha gal.
They don't have alpha gal, and they have these, their big leg muscles make really good steak.
Oh, okay.
So
That's a good thing to know. I'm sure
the
some of the
best
fancy
answer you
restaurants in
can.
the Hamptons have that, I'm sure.
But I think you need to get emu from a farm that's growing emus.
But how long would you tell somebody, like even like yourself? I mean, you have to wait a year, 2 years? Do you check antibodies? Like, how do you know when it's safe to try red meat again?
Goes down, and it goes down below 1%. Definitely, I'd be willing to talk about it. But and an awful lot, I'm a real adult physician, and as I get up, I find that my patients are more up too. Very odd. And actually, people my age shouldn't be eating red meat anyway. There's no doubt there's cardiac risk involved,
Yeah.
and we think the cardiac risk is increased with people with alpha gal, but it's not. It's just a reason for not eating red meat. And if you
Well,
can
let's say
eat
it's a, no, let's say it's a younger patient. Like I had a 30-year-old, a couple of months ago, and he did. He obviously he was happy we diagnosed him, and and I gave him the list of things to be careful about. And he, like again, he turns to me, Dr. Mitchell. He goes, when do you think I'm gonna have that steak again? And the thing is, Dr. Plasmo, this is interesting in our field, though, because I mean, what I've read is that it does go down really in a short amount of, I mean, relatively short in time, a year, 2 years. Most food allergies, especially as adults, do not go away. I mean, IgE has a way of hanging around. So again, have you guys monitored, or do you feel confident?
We've monitored a lot of people, and there are people like me. I've been way high, over 100 at times, but I'm now down to about 20, and it seems I'm going to stay at that level. I'm not going down steadily. And there are other people who really 2 years later, they're down, and they've gone away and they can eat it. And they've found out, and many of those find out for themselves.
Do you think this is the tip of the iceberg? Do you think we're going to find out more syndromes like this, or is this fairly unique?
I'm not convinced there's going to be another one as beautiful as this. So there's a do you know about pork cat syndrome?
I've heard of, I guess I was confused because I always, I would see when I would do my blood, testing for food and environmental allergies, that patients that had like a very strong cat allergy would show a positive to pork. And again, I was taught that it was really like a cross reaction between their proteins. So maybe tell me, what is pork cat allergy?
It's cross-reactivity between the albumin of cat and the albumin of pork. And it was discovered in France and just studied in detail by Christiane Hilger in Belgium. And she proved that it was albumin that was cross-reactivity. And I had a lovely patient came in 3 weeks ago, and she'd been told she had alpha gal and a level like the one you're describing of 0.18. And I thought, but I already knew that her pork had come back as 5. So with alpha gal, we would never see 0.18 and a pork of 5. The pork values are very rarely.
Oh, I just saw a patient with that. So you're saying also, besides the alpha gal, even though they're reacting to the alpha gal in pork, I mean, they're actually IgE, the pork and the beef itself will be elevated?
The pork test will be
Well, the
elevated.
pork would be, okay, in this
So
case.
yes, so this lady, it turned out that her IgE to cat was well over 100, and her IgE to cat albumin was 120. That is 1,000 times higher than the alpha gal. And when you see that, you say, no, madam, your reactions are due to pork albumin cross-reacting with cat. And I said, do you get allergic symptoms from cat? Really? They had a cat at home. I sneeze a bit and take antihistamines once in a while, but it's not a problem. But this pork reaction is quite severe and happens
Huh.
in half an hour. So it's completely different. And it's nice because her parents had come. She's a HR specialist in Washington and fully intelligent woman with almost grown up children. But her parents wanted me to know that it was Alpha-Gal syndrome. I said, yes, it's not really. Actually, it's poor cat. And we showed, we did the blood tests, told her the result. She was very happy. But she said to me, I read that article, but I thought it was too crazy. And it's part of what we had to deal with the early years of AlphaGal, because people said, that's crazy. You can't become allergic to something in the middle of your life. We can't be made allergic by tick bites. We can't wait for 4 hours after reaction. Everything was wrong. But that was actually, it turns out to be right.
Well, let me ask you something too, again, because I said, I have followed your publications over many years, and really since I took my boards 30 years ago. I'm going to date us, because you know, you always had some very when you write something, it's usually what I find very meaningful, not just adding another publication to your list. But
I'm guilty. I have written some potboilers.
But you had a lot of work in your days with dust mites, and I'm just curious too, because I know from practice, you know, patients that have very high dust mite scores and very allergic to dust mites, that cross reacts with shellfish. I was just wondering if you can explain a little bit. Is that, you know, because we know that with fruits, like when somebody's very allergic to birch pollen, they can react to apples and other right. birch related fruits, but it's usually not a serious reaction. It's usually like itching the mouth. But with dust mites to shellfish, is that different?
Yeah. Well, the relevant antigen is atropomycin, that is a muscle related antigen in the mites. And a muscle-related antigen of shrimps. And these muscle-related muscles are so important to animals that those proteins are very well conserved. And so there's strong cross-reactivity between DERP10, which is the tropomyosin, and the same type of molecule in the shrimp. And you can get severe reactions. The bulk of dust mites don't have that reaction.
So you're saying most people with dust mite allergy do not, which you're right. I mean, what I've seen in my practice, most of them do not have significant or dangerous shellfish allergy, but there can be a proportion of them that can.
Absolutely. So if you see someone with shrimp, it's well worth testing for that specific protein, the IgE to that protein. And that's in most people like LabCorp or Viracor or whatever.
Well, component testing is helpful for that, correct? I mean, yes. When you break down and you can see whether it's cross-reactivity or if it's one of the dangerous components.
And I regard AlphaGal, well, AlphaGal is odd because it's a cross between a cross-reactive carbohydrate, you know, which is the MUXF3 group, which cross-reacts so wildly. AlphaGal also reacts quite wildly, but gives bad symptoms. But they're both a component that is widely spread.
Okay. All right, Dr. Plasmiller, as we wrap up, and I tell listeners to really be aware of this, I mean, how this fascinating case of a pilot, it's still in the prime of his life, unfortunately dying from this Alpha-Gal syndrome, this severe allergic reaction, which is a result of having gotten these tick bites and then the reaction to foods. Is there anything that we didn't really cover that you'd like to mention? I just want to make sure.
I would just like to say that in New Jersey, it was clearly the rise in the number of deer that brought with it enormous numbers of ticks. This tick, Lone Star, primarily grows on deer, and there are a lot of deer in the north end of Long Island.
Yes.
And they carry them. Turkeys can also carry it. And I heard recently that in Iceland, they get Alpha-Gal syndrome from ticks and the puffins.
What is a puffin?
What is a puffin? I see a New Yorker.
Yes,
puffin is a bird.
The closest I get to a farm is a supermarket.
It's a beautiful bird, puffin. They nest on the cliffs of Iceland.
You know, it seems like these damn ticks are defeating us. We're going to win this battle. I mean, between Lyme disease and everything else. I mean, you know, we deal with a lot of things, but it seems like they are winning the battle. Is there anything actually that they suggest in Virginia or in these places, you know, to try to decrease tick population? No.
Short of really reducing the deer back to their normal population, the number of deer in Albemarle County, Virginia, in 1950 was close to zero. They were wiped out. So the deer had gone. They were reintroduced by the Virginia State Game Commission. And I met one of the farmers who'd from the valley who'd come over and introduced deer into Albemarle. And he said, no, the dogs were the primary problem. The dogs would hunt down the fawns and kill them. And so that if we take our dogs off their collars, know that a dog is actually an animal. It's not meant to have a collar around its neck. And if they have a collar around the neck, they can't hunt the deer.
I didn't, you know, it's funny. I didn't know the dogs would hunt the deer. You know, I saw a deer in my backyard last summer. I was actually came up very close, which it wasn't typical of our area. And what really struck was one, how large they are,
The deer.
full they are.
You
But it was striking. I can't explain
sure
it. And what's that?
it wasn't a moose?
It might have been, no, but I think it was a
Moose,
deer.
mooses
But
are big moose, but you know that the moose in New England are getting a different tick on them, which is sucking their blood. Some of them have these ticks on them and are dying of it. And no, ticks are a serious issue. I'm not doubting that. They're causing real trouble in many
I
places.
feel bad for all the people that are nature lovers and hikers and gardeners. This is something that you have to really be
Well, then
careful
just
about.
go vegetarian and suck it up.
I did that for it wasn't so good for me.
Okay.
Okay, Dr. Platt, Thomas Platts Mills, I want to thank you for coming on. I want to thank you for your contributions to allergy all these years. As I said, I followed you carefully. You do amazing work. I think this was a super important thing that people should be aware of, and I hope everyone is a little bit aware of it and careful when they're out in nature.
Dr. Dean Mitchell, thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Platts Mills. Seriously, it was an honor having you on.
Thanks for joining me here on UK Health Radio. I'm Dr. Dean Mitchell. If today's conversation was useful to you, please share it with someone who could benefit. You can find every episode of The Smartest Doctor in the Room wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time, stay well.